Welcome to the World Vision Report. This week, making trashy bags in Ghana.
This is actually called the trashy smart bag. It zips up into a pouch.
And fighting New Delhi's infamous traffic on Facebook.
No one has got the fear in their mind. We need to get the fear thing in their mind.
When professionals leave Africa for jobs in the West, does it always create brain drain?
Brain drain suggests a one-way flow of human capital that's built in Africa and then it's sucked into the Western world. And it's more brain circulation.
And the music of a legendary Libyan musician whose teen heroes were Robert Plant and Jimi Hendrix. Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. First, this hour's news. Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. There was a sense of urgency at the UN this week. Leaders from around the world gathered to assess how much progress has been made in achieving the Millennium Development Goals. The goals were agreed on at a summit in the year 2000. They include cutting worldwide poverty and hunger in half. And there was a deadline, 2015. That's just 5 years away. So what kind of progress has been made? And is it really possible to finish it up in 5 years? John MacArthur joins me now. He's the CEO of Millennium Promise, a nonprofit organization dedicated to cutting poverty in half. He says there's been progress.
At a global level, for example, the goal for tackling income poverty, people living on less than a dollar a day, is basically on track. A little bit of turbulence in the past couple of years. We don't know the exact numbers at the moment, but generally speaking, especially because of the progress in Asia, we've seen hundreds of millions of people lifted out of extreme poverty. And on average, the world is on track to achieve this goal. We've seen other big breakthroughs, areas like HIV/AIDS control, a lot of U.S. leadership in that effort globally, malaria control, very similar story, where at the beginning of the decade, when these goals were set, there was basically no one in Africa, for example, on antiretroviral treatment to fight AIDS. Now we have millions of people on treatment. Even 5 years ago, there was almost no serious international effort to tackle malaria control, despite the best efforts of a lot of malaria specialists. Now we've seen just in the past 2 years, more than 200 million long-lasting bed nets distributed en route to every sleeping site in Africa that needs a bed net, getting a bed net.
So John, we've talked about the breakthroughs and where there's progress, but the success hasn't really been spread around equally. You mentioned Asia. China's dramatic economic rise has kind of skewed the numbers. So I'm wondering if you could point out for us where the good news is really taking place. And where things aren't improving fast enough.
Well, there are a couple ways to think about the good news. One is in Asia, of course, the economic and general prosperity of livelihoods is getting better and better. There are some challenges. We're seeing the challenge of hunger, for example, in India is very persistent. But I think the biggest story around the Millennium Development Goals remains in Africa in terms of the variation in progress that we've seen in the past 10 years and the gaps that still need to be taken on. Across Africa, which still remains on average the poorest part of the world, seeing the least general progress, we've seen several countries actually have breakthroughs. Places like Rwanda, like Malawi, like Ethiopia, like Ghana, places where the governments have been very committed to very practical programs for education, for health, for agriculture, and those have really inspired much broader scale-up successes. So even though Africa itself, on average, is not doing as well as the rest of the world, there are many countries in Africa that are showing just how these goals can be achieved.
And which countries are suffering the most? Which ones have the thorniest problems to solve where we're not seeing real growth in these Millennium Goals?
I guess the toughest situations are the ones that we might read about in the headlines the most. Unfortunately, we don't read about the success stories every day, but we do hear about the real tough situations. And those would be probably the conflict situations. Places like Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo.
All right. Well, let's talk about where the goals are far from being met, where there's still a lot of work to be done. And that's mainly in reducing the number of deaths of young children and of mothers who die in childbirth. And the UN apparently has just announced it's dedicating more money to improve the lives of women and young children. Why is it that this goal's been so difficult to achieve?
It has been difficult to tackle the maternal mortality challenge for a few reasons. One is, I would say, bias. And there is certainly a lot of gender bias in the world, and the issues of mothers haven't got as much attention as they should have. At the same time, there's a challenge of systems that needs to be addressed in order to get mothers in safe delivery situations where the emergencies can be tackled. In the poorest parts of the world, where the mothers are most often dying of labor-related causes, it's because they don't get to a clinic, because there's been no clinic in which they could deliver a baby. It's because there hasn't been a skilled birth attendant available. It's because they haven't been able to get to a surgical theater for a safe C-section. So these are very practical things. And when you're starting from a non-existent health system by our standards, and really just barely anything to speak of locally, to get to the systems layer whereby mothers can have that emergency service with the skilled attendant and the surgical theater is really, I think, the next big breakthrough. And that needs local staff. So getting those systems in place is kind of the next frontier from a technical and policy level, but also it's a slightly trickier set of problems compared to, say, getting immunizations out or getting bed nets out.
Okay. Thank you so much, John MacArthur.
Thank you so much for having me.
John MacArthur is the CEO of Millennium Promise. For more information about the Millennium Development Goals and about the recent meeting in New York, go to our website at www.worldvisionreport.org. Some of the problems Africa faces have been blamed on brain drain. We'll look at that issue a bit more closely later in the show. Now, though, we turn our attention from poverty abroad to poverty at home, and there's plenty of it. 1 in 7 Americans now lives in poverty. That number ricocheted around the country last week when the 2009 census figures came out. Almost 44 million Americans live below the poverty line. It's difficult to put a human face on numbers like these, but Michelle Barwell can help us do just that. She's a psychiatrist who cares for the homeless on the streets of Pittsburgh. Reporter Erica Barris recently accompanied the doctor on her Monday night rounds.
What are you doing tonight? Just hanging out?
Michelle Barwell is a familiar sight in the streets of downtown Pittsburgh. Each Monday night, she makes her way by highway underpasses, along riverbanks, and through small alleys to get to her patients.
Do you need a prescription before you go so you can be sure to get medicine?
You gave me 60 days.
Okay.
Barwell, who's a psychiatrist, stands on a street corner talking to a homeless man. She acts casual, as if they're chatting about the weather and not about his lifelong struggle with mental illness. 7 years ago, Barwell started volunteering with Operation Safety Net, a group of physicians who care for street people. Last year, she started getting paid for her work. Barwell is the only psychiatrist practicing out here. The 39-year-old says mental health professionals are especially needed on the streets.
I think on a national basis, about 25% of chronically homeless population have severe mental illness compared to about 6% of Americans overall.
Did you get your application into Wood Street?
Barwell builds up relationships with people here, with the hope of getting them to visit her office. It's not easy, but she's got a not-so-secret weapon. It's Barwell's dog, Max.
Max.
A half-mastiff, half-lab. People seem to love him, and he seems to enjoy their attention. But despite the banter that occurs on city sidewalks, Barwell often struggles to get homeless patients into her office.
I think it takes working with them on the street and often treating them on the street for a significant amount of time before they're able to commit to coming in. Sometimes it takes having a case manager pick them up, and sometimes it takes just creating enough of a trust, a trusting relationship for them to feel comfortable and safe leaving the street and walking in the doors to see the doctor.
That's the case with Augustus Hudgens, a severely mentally ill man who has spent decades in institutions and on the street. After months of seeing Barwell on her rounds, he started going in for weekly appointments. He looked like he was on his way to becoming a success story. But tonight, he's got some bad news for her.
Are you? You're leaving us.
Hudgens tells her he's moving to Philadelphia. Barwell doubts he'll seek out treatment there.
I'm going to miss you.
It's not often that someone like Augustus will go to the next city and say, hey, here are the people I was working with. Here are their phone numbers. Why don't you check with them and they can tell you what's going on with me?
Barwell comes from a family that has a fair amount of mental illness itself. Her grandmother had bipolar disorder. Her brother also had the disease and committed suicide. And her father, a Vietnam vet, has PTSD.
So I think growing up, watching him struggle with that illness also probably helped me develop into the sort of person that would want to do this work.
Barwell was recruited to work for Operation Safety Net by the group's founder, Dr. Jim Withers. An internist, he says it was difficult for him to figure out how to maneuver the world of mental health services until Barwell came along.
We've been sort of outsiders with our patients and sort of coming hat in hand many times, asking the psychiatry world to please consider taking care of this person. And many times we've felt as rejected almost as the patients. So having an insider there who can pick up the phone and say, you know, I'm a qualified psychiatrist. You know, I've worked with you, or I know your system. And she knows the jargon and things. You know, she can advocate for people in a way that I could never do.
In a downtown park, a street person named Al says he's a recovering drug addict and has PTSD. He says he wants to see Dr. Barwell in her office.
I want to talk to her. I want to see if she can help me deal with some of it. I'm hoping maybe I can get medicated.
Barwell won't do a diagnosis on the street. But if someone says they've been on a psychiatric drug, she'll quiz them. What was its name? What did the pills look like? What's the name of your doctor? As long as the medication doesn't require blood work and isn't a controlled substance, she'll write the prescription. People don't always take their medications or even fill them. It can be frustrating, says Barwell.
For people who need big victories to celebrate, I think this work would get frustrating and would be disheartening. But when you work hard with people who have so little and expect so little, every little gain for them becomes a big victory for all of us.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Erica Barris in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
I caught up with Dr. Barwell this week to ask her, in light of the new poverty stats, what changes she's seeing on the streets of Pittsburgh.
A year ago, most of the people that we saw were chronically homeless, some for reasons having to do with mental health or substance abuse, and others for more complicated issues. But now we are seeing people who have never been homeless before and are experiencing the loss of stability for the first time.
Dr. Barwell also told me that this shift in the homeless population has meant some changes to her workload.
I'm not only helping people with medication for depression or severe anxiety, but I'm also helping to fill out a lot of forms and help people navigate the system for places that really can help displaced workers with individual needs.
Dr. Michelle Barwell is a psychiatrist working with Operation Safety Net in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Coming up, Facebook might be great if you want to connect with friends, not so great if it's the police who poke you. That story from India, next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymire with the World Vision Report. The movie The Social Network opens next week. That's the film about the contentious beginnings of Facebook back in 2003 at Harvard.
People want to go on the internet and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that? Friends, pictures, profiles. I'm talking about taking the entire social experience of college and putting it online.
Ah, but we know Facebook became so much more than that. Seems like everyone and everything is on it now, including the New Delhi traffic police. Reporter Elliot Hannon joins us with more.
Satyinder Garg doesn't look like your average Facebook junkie. In India, Facebook is still largely for the young and tech-savvy, not graying government employees. Garg, however, sits behind his desk at the New Delhi police headquarters, commenting on posts and responding to friend requests. Until recently, he had never even tried Facebook. But when he took over the Delhi traffic police earlier this year, he faced a stark reality.
In Delhi, like, we have got 6.5 million vehicles on the roads. And maybe like 2 million coming to Delhi every day from nearby towns. And this is a terrible number.
With only several thousand officers to patrol the roads every day, and without traffic cameras to catch drivers speeding and running red lights, he was overmatched. So he turned to Facebook for help in taming the city's congestion problems.
Basically, the idea behind Facebook was That is a two-way interaction. We wanted to interact with the road users from our side. But at the same time, we wanted honest feedback from people, the road users, like what difficulties they face.
So a few months ago, the Delhi Traffic Police started a Facebook page. Since then, its membership has grown to more than 25,000 drivers, like Karen Agarwal. Agarwal's daily commute is only about 8 miles, but it can take up to an hour. He posts regularly on the page about the problems he sees. I joined him for his morning commute.
Like getting out of your house is like getting stuck in a jam. People are not following traffic rules. We want that people should follow traffic rules. Like, see, this, he's also, someone will hit him, who will be responsible tomorrow?
Agarwal points out the violations as he maneuvers through a swirl of cars veering in every direction. The problem, he says, is that traffic tickets are given so rarely that they're not much of a deterrent.
No one has got the fear in their mind. We need to get the fear thing in their mind.
To help with that fear thing, the Delhi traffic page allows anyone to upload photos of offenders caught in the act. Most of the photos are taken with cell phones. If there's enough evidence, police will issue a ticket. Already 6,000 pictures have been uploaded, and over 1,000 tickets issued thanks to Facebook informants. At the traffic headquarters, walkie-talkies squawk as officers call in violations from the road. T. Yashwan, a traffic inspector, says the surge in photos has led to the creation of a brand new department.
We have a 4 shifts. One person sit on this Facebook, so we work round the clock, 24/7.
He peers over the shoulder of a young officer clicking through Facebook photos of buses parked on the sidewalk, taxis running red lights, and drivers caught weaving in and out of traffic. Rakesh Arora is the owner of a security company in Delhi. Speaking from his car, he says he's uploaded 12 photos he's taken during his commute.
I can't leave my own business or I can't leave my own job and be on the road to and take the pictures of all the violators. But what I'm doing is I'm assisting Delhi Traffic Police by clicking some of the photographs.
And what about people out to settle a score by getting someone in trouble? So far, there hasn't been a single complaint, says Traffic Commissioner Satyendra Garg. Garg says that the threat of criminal charges for those out for revenge and pictures that are doctored has been a good deterrent. During his morning commute, Karen Agarwal says he contributes to the site by notifying the police of problems like broken traffic lights. But he doesn't like the idea of nabbing fellow drivers. That, he says, is what the traffic cops are for.
It's their duty to look at it. Why they want us to do the work. I'm not authorized to click anyone's picture.
Tara Singh leans on his dented black taxi in South Delhi. He's driven a cab here for 12 years. His home is in northern India, and he spends the night under a plastic tarped roof with other drivers at the cab stand. Singh says even though he doesn't know much about Delhi's new online traffic cops, he thinks it's worth a try.
I'm not entirely sure whether it will help. As for me, I'm a pretty good driver. I've gotten a ticket only once in my life. If I made a mistake, I wouldn't mind if someone caught me, if it will make the roads better.
In his office, Satyendra Garg browses his department's Facebook page, responding to questions and concerns.
See, all this is in less than 24 hours. I mean, maybe 1,000 posts.
1,000 posts in 24 hours, he says. Garg thinks enlisting drivers to post pictures has been a positive step. His only word of caution is that photos shouldn't be taken while driving. That, he says, is also a ticketable offense. For the World Vision Report, this is Elliot Hannon in New Delhi.
And here's another Facebook page to take a look at. It's for Buzkashi. That means literally goat grabber. Our global guru tells us more.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. This week we ask one simple question, just one from somewhere in the world. Today we're in Afghanistan asking, what's Buzkashi?
The rules are very simple. You pick up the goat or the calf, you take it around the flag, you bring it back, and you throw then the circle of halal.
I'm speaking with the president of the Afghan Sports Federation.
My name is Anjuman Ghani.
He's telling me about Afghanistan's national sport, Buzkashi. It's like polo, except in place of a ball.
It is a dead calf that is slaughtered in the internal parts of the bodies are taken out, and the body is soaked in water for 24 hours in order for the carcass to become a bit hard. And what happens is they cut the leg all the way to the knee.
Okay, so apart from the unfortunate ball, how do you actually play?
You have to have three things. You have to have a horse, you have to have a rider, and you have to have a tool to play with.
And the rules?
You have two teams, possibly 10 people, 10 players or 10 riders in each team. And at a distance, depending on the field, they would have a flag. And they would have another circle in the same vicinity of the first circle. The riders would have to pick up the calf around the pole and bring it back and throw it in this other circle.
That's the circle of halal. And it means?
Something that is pure.
Ghani says you have to be in wicked good shape to play. The calf alone weighs
at least 200 pounds.
And the horses need extreme training.
If a rider falls, then the horse stands right next to its rider. And these are special horses.
No one's exactly sure where buzkashi came from. The Mongol invasion in the 13th century, perhaps. But it's played all over, from Tajikistan and Uzbekistan to China. And it's dangerous.
It's extremely fast-paced game. There's a lot of pushing and shoving by the riders. Not a moment of dullness.
Players are older, in their 30s and 40s, and the strongest of them wins. Still, Ghani compares it to rugby or American football.
You know, we're humans. We have basically the same games.
The Global Guru is produced in association with American University's College of Arts and Sciences and WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Original theme by The Plush Interiors. To submit ideas, email globalguru@american.edu. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Thanks for listening.
Nasser Mizdawi is a Libyan superstar. He brought pop to the Libyan music scene when the country had just emerged from a revolution. The government was against anything that smacked of Western influence, and that included Mizdawi's music. But he and his music survived. Dale Gavlak caught up with him in the Libyan capital, Tripoli, and she brings us this story.
Like any true musical genius, Nasser Mizdawi always seems to be on the cusp of something new. I caught up with him in a recording studio in Tripoli.
This is my guitar solo. I'm playing solo.
It's a song about space travel.
Fantasy song. I'm walking.
A fantastic encounter with an alien. Exploring one's own dreams. Mizdawi has spent much of his 60 years doing just that. The award-winning singer-songwriter was the only musician in his family when he started to play the guitar at age 10. He loved listening to rock greats like Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin. 6 years later, in the mid-60s, he performed with foreign bands when Libya was still a kingdom.
And this time, there is many discotheques, many in the time of the kingdom. I was young and I play good in the guitar and my voice is good. I can sing in Italian and English in that time. But then I think to make my own songs, and I started to write in Arab words, the Western music, you know.
Libya, like much of the Arab world at the time, was focused on its own traditional music. Mizdawi created a fusion between that and Western music. Mizdawi's first hit, Mashina, or Walking, went gold in 1976. We listened to it together in a studio. The music brings a smile to his face.
All the Egyptian bands learning from my style when they do the Arab music.
The result revolutionized Arab pop music forever, says Mideast music expert Naji Al-Mahroug.
It was something incomprehensible at the time, mixing Arabic music with other music. But Mizdawi succeeded in making it happen. We moved into a new era. The music stirred something in us as Libyans.
But another revolution, one of politics, also swept through Libya. Led by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, it sought to rid the country of its turbulent European colonial past and rejected Western influences.
My music was forbidden, and they prevented other musicians from using such techniques because they were considered Western. Maybe from the politicians' point of view, they were right at the time. They kept me from performing before live audiences. So I left for Egypt, where there was a different mentality. I thank God that music cannot be stopped by boundaries.
In Egypt, he teamed up with Egyptian pop singing sensation Amr Diab to write Nur El Ain, or Light of My Eye. A tremendous triumph in the Mideast, it became a massive crossover hit globally. Over the years, Nasser also lived in Jordan and Iraq, but he returned to Libya in 1997 because he says he simply wanted to return home. His music can now be bought and played here. He's also performing in public a bit now. Sound engineer Naji Tabel is a devout fan of Mizdawi's music.
When you go on the streets, it's his music you hear. He's a troubadour, not just of love or relationships. He communicates about human emotions like being away from home, your country. You feel that he's trying to reach you with his music.
At age 60, Mizdawi still presses ahead with plans for concerts around the world. He seems to be optimistic about the future.
The Libyan government is still a little conservative, but the fact that my music is now allowed to be heard is a very good sign.
Mizdawi says the Libyan government is even thinking of sending him to the U.S. as a cultural representative. I'm Dale Gavlak for the World Vision Report in Tripoli, Libya.
Last week, as part of our series on migration in Mexico, our reporter Grant Fuller hopped a train to join a teenage migrant heading north to the U.S. border. But migrants south of the border aren't just hopping trains. They're also rafting rivers to get to family and jobs in the U.S. The Rio Suchiate flows along the border between Mexico and Guatemala. Every day, Central American migrants pay local raft owners to help them cross the river so they can head through Mexico to the United States. Once again, our reporter Grant Fuller joined the migrants, this time by crossing the river on a raft. Here's his reporter's notebook.
It's nearly dark, and I'm on a mission. Cross the Suchiate River into Guatemala, find some Central American migrants, and cross back into Mexico with them. I stumble a little trying to step from the muddy shore to the raft. It belongs to a Guatemalan named Eduardo Ortiz, and I've hired him to guide me across. The raft is made of two giant inner tubes with a pallet of five wooden planks lashed to the top. It's about the length of a car. Ortiz tells me it's dangerous to stand up like him, so I catch my balance and sit down Indian style.
Okay.
Ortiz has been crossing this river for 3 years. He's 17 years old, and he has a helper who's only 12. Ortiz uses a long wooden pole to push off the shallow river bottom and get people across. Raft boys like him are often paid by local merchants to transport their goods into Mexico. But some of their most frequent customers are illegal migrants from Central America.
Sometimes we get Hondurans, Nicaraguans, Salvadorians. They're all on their way north to the United States, looking for the good life.
It costs just over a dollar to be ferried across the river. Ortiz knows helping migrants is illegal, and the crossing is not at all hidden. But when trouble comes, there's an easy way out.
The police are always coming for us, but you just give them a bribe, and they'll calm down and leave.
We reach the other side, and I step into Guatemala.
Gracias.
Five or six rafters hang around the banks, waiting for passengers. I ask Ortiz about a white cross I see near the water.
La cruz tiene un significado.
That cross represents all the illegals who have died on their journey. When migrants pass through, they leave candles, or they stop there and pray that they'll have a safe trip.
But right now, there are no migrants in sight. An older woman promptly warns me not to walk around alone. You will be robbed, she says with certainty. The night closes in fast, and I'm about ready to give up. After heavy rains all day long, the river is moving more swiftly. You should cross back now, I'm told, before it gets too dangerous. As I walk down to the water, I notice a couple guys near the White Cross making a beeline for a raft. With telltale backpacks and baseball caps, they're easy to spot. Migrants. I end up on the same raft with them. Our raft man struggles to push against the current as trash floats past us. After just a couple minutes, we reach the Mexican side and the migrants take off immediately. I have to run to catch up.
Oh yeah, amigos.
Hey guys, I holler. Where are you from? Probably not the smartest introduction, but I get an answer. Nicaragua, they say. And the look on their faces says, why do you want to know? As I try to explain myself, the raft owner chases me down, demanding money. Oops, I've forgotten to pay for the river crossing. I pull out 100 pesos. The Nicaraguans are impatient and nervous. We gotta go, they say, backing away. I quickly thank the raft crew and speed walk up to the migrants, breathlessly trying to explain that I'm working on a radio story about the guys they paid to cross them over. They're in a hurry, hoping to catch a minibus to a migrant shelter before it gets too late. They're in no mood for nosy questions. But I'm going back to Tapachula anyway, so they agree we should take the bus together. I finally found what I was looking for. And back at the river, under cover of darkness, more migrants cross into Mexico, where many more obstacles stand between them and the United States.
Grant Fuller is the World Vision Report's Mexico correspondent. He's based in Mexico City. African immigrants are often resented in their own countries when they take their skills and talents somewhere else. Hear what one Ghanaian economist says about brain drain next on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In Africa, doctors, nurses, and intellectuals are leaving their home countries for jobs overseas. Africans are alarmed by the brain drain. They worry that rich countries could suck all the talent and energy out of Africa, leaving the continent even worse off. But could the brain drain actually be good for Africa? That's the opinion of NYU economist Yao Nyarko. We've invited Dr. Nyarko onto the show to explain.
The strongest argument, I think, is just that the very term itself suggests something which isn't real. So brain drain suggests a one-way flow of human capital that's built in Africa and then it's sucked into the Western world. And it's more brain circulation. People leave, a lot of people come back, they go again. And it's that flow of people, ideas, money, business opportunities that's actually very, very important for Africa's growth.
Well, let me ask you a question that comes from a lot of the critics. And let's take your home country, Ghana. The numbers are pretty significant. As I understand it, half of the people in Ghana who have college degrees have left Ghana, have come to countries like the United States and also European countries. I mean, you say the brain is circulating, but doesn't it prevent them from not only working in Ghana and helping their country, but investing in and training the next generation if they leave like this?
A lot of the people who have left Ghana are actually helping Ghana in many, many ways. So the fact that half of them are away doesn't mean that they're not doing anything. Everything from remittances, which is now one of the leading foreign exchange earners for countries like Ghana.
Let's explain real quickly, if you would, just for people who might not know, remittances are when people who leave the country actually send money back in to their families and friends.
Exactly. So a lot of Ghanaians who are outside of Ghana, maintain strong ties with their home country. They look after people. You know, you take my own case. I left Ghana at a time when Ghana wasn't doing that well. If I had stayed in Ghana at that particular time, I'd be in need of somebody sending me remittances. Instead, I was able to leave, and I'm supporting many people back home through the monies I send back. That's a good thing.
You would be somebody who others would call an example of the brain drain. You couldn't even find a job in Ghana, right?
I could not find a job in Ghana. I remember going back to the economics department, I'm an economist, knocking on doors and actually looking for positions. And I remember the chair of the department saying to me that there are no positions at this particular time and, you know, maybe try again in a couple of years or something like that. You'll be surprised that in many nations, the job opportunities for people who are abroad simply don't exist at any salary level.
Really? And so here you are at NYU, which is a great university, and it's not surprising that you would choose to stay at a place like NYU instead of being unemployed in Ghana.
I think many people would choose the same as well.
What have you heard from other immigrants like yourself?
Just to give you two examples, a good friend of mine, Patrick Awa, used to work for Microsoft in the early days, made some money, and went back and started a new university, Ashesi University, which is a fantastic place. It's modeled along the lines of Swarthmore University, and that's his contribution back to his home country, Ghana. Another classmate of mine, Ken Ofuriata, he left Ghana roughly the same time I did, and he went back and he's formed a company called Data Bank, which is Ghana's best, I think, foremost investment bank. And I think each one would say that they wouldn't be able to do what they've done if they didn't have the opportunity to travel abroad.
I think what many people don't know is that so much education is subsidized in Africa. Higher education is almost totally subsidized by the government. So African governments are investing all of this money into doctors, nurses, intellectuals, and then they leave. So you could understand if these governments and taxpayers in those countries would be resentful. It's kind of like a double whammy. They get their education paid for, assuming they'll stay and help their country, and then they end up exiting.
That, you know, on the face of it sounds correct. When you dig in a bit more, you find a number of, you know, there are a number of arguments against that, okay? I've actually, in one of the papers, gone through and actually computed how much the government spends on the typical person. And it ranges about $1,000 a year, okay? It might sound low to many Americans, but that's what the numbers show, okay, for a country like Ghana. So let's take those people who leave. You can say the government has lost, you know, $4,000 for the 4 years that they've been educated. But then you start to sum up all the positive contributions of people like that, the half that come back. So I just mentioned things like Ashesi University. I mentioned Data Bank. Many of the people also, don't forget, after they've left Ghana, get further training, as I did, from Western universities. And then a fraction of them also go back with superior skills. And then on top of all of that, you add into it all these remittances I just mentioned. Okay, so the people who leave and stay abroad, they send money back. A lot of the money goes into the rural areas to look after people who are very, very poor, very destitute, children who need school fees and all of that. So if that source of income wasn't there, the government would have to look for it if it cares about the poor people of the country. So in some sense, you can think of all of this as a return on investment. And when you do the pluses and minuses of that, we actually find that on net, it's not bad. You know, it's there's a small net positive to this, what I'm calling brain circulation.
There's been a lot of talk about the healthcare deficit on the African continent. Many African countries are in desperate need of doctors and nurses. So many of them are heading to these better jobs overseas in England, places like England. And the UK has actually been working to limit recruitment from overseas to stem this, to try to help the African countries because it's become such a problem. Wouldn't there be an argument that it might be better to have doctors and nurses staying in their own countries?
So doctors and nurses and the medical field is one area where we always, you know, have the most passion. I never really hear people saying, well, we're losing all the economists or all the lawyers. The doctors, you get the passion.
Because you can live without an economist, right?
There you
I don't
go.
Want, I'm sorry to hurt your feelings, but...
No problem.
If you've got HIV or malaria, you're not going to call the economist.
That's right. So listen, this is the issue, okay? The main issue is not so much that the doctors are leaving. The bigger problem, in my mind, is that there are not enough doctors to begin with. Many medical schools in Africa only started operation. Ghana's medical school, I think, started in 1969 or thereabouts. The total number of doctors, the last time we, you know, official statistics, 2004, was of the order of 3,000. These are all doctors in Ghana and outside of Ghana. Just to give you context, my own university, New York University, has a medical school, and the number of medical students in the school at any given time is of the order of 2,000 or around there. You have an entire nation of, you know, 2004 numbers, 20 million. Today it's about 24 million people. And the total number of doctors you have in Ghana, outside Ghana, all of 3,000, okay? So the issue is more that countries like Ghana, which now have maybe 2 or 3 medical schools, need to have 20 or 30 medical schools. In some of my work, I've advocated, look, let's find a way, perhaps those who leave, let's tax them a little bit or ask them to pay back loans or something like that so that we can get to a stage where we have 10 times as many medical schools as we currently do. That's the only thing that will bring the number of doctors per patient to a nice enough level.
Dr. Nyarko, in your article, you and your partner William Easterly write about the focus on the individual versus the community. And I think it's one of your most compelling arguments that so often when we think about something like brain drain, we're thinking about the community left behind, the country left behind, and very little is said about the huge improvement to the individual like yourself who leaves and gets to start a new and much better life abroad. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Maybe even using Dr. Easterly as an example, because he's a great example of how his life has changed.
My colleague and friend, Bill Easterly, likes to tell the story that he was born and raised in West Virginia, and the school system there educated him through taxpayers, West Virginian taxpayers. He then left, did his graduate work, and is living in New York. When the government, when the taxpayers of West Virginia are deciding what to do for their people, shouldn't they say, well, maybe if we educate some of our people, we will make them happier. They may not stay in West Virginia, but West Virginians, those who are born and remain there and those who are born there and leave, are all collectively happier. He likes to tell the story of, you know, let's suppose in the United States, there was a law that you can't leave the U.S. Because it's brain drain. There's a law that if you're a doctor in the United States, you can't go and work in France if you feel like working there. If you're a business person in the United States who's been educated by American taxpayer dollars, you can't work in the UK or Germany or something like that. Most Americans would say, one, that that's a restriction of their basic freedoms. And two, they would say, look, the governments are spending money on all of us and what we do, how we do it, that's our own personal business. Okay, so that's sort of the philosophical argument behind that. I think Bill has remarked that several times, and I completely agree that when it comes to Africa, there always seems to be a double standard. It's okay to say for Africans that, well, look, you guys, if you're educated in Africa, you cannot leave. You have to stay in your home countries. But Americans, on the other hand, well, you can do whatever you want. So those are some of the arguments, and it's true. I'm a happier person because I was allowed to leave Ghana. If I was forced to stay in Ghana, I would probably be unemployed. I wouldn't be able to further my education. And how that's good for Ghana or Ghanaians, I just don't know.
Dr. Yao Nyarko is an economist at New York University. Dr. Nyarko, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, too. It's been a pleasure.
Even though professionals are leaving Africa, there's innovation happening all over the continent. We'll look at just one example in this week's Globe at a Glance. You've heard of Wikipedia, but how about Immunopedia? It's a website that gives up-to-date information on immunology. That's the study of viruses and other pathogens and how the body responds to them. An immunologist in South Africa founded the website. Dr. Clive Gray says pediatricians there treat as many as 100 HIV-positive children every day. That leaves them hardly any time to catch up on the latest drugs and treatments. So the website is a one-stop shopping site where doctors can research case studies and get updates on new HIV drugs and other treatments. The site launched 4 years ago, and now about 3,000 doctors and health professionals use it every month. Immunopedia has become another weapon in the ongoing battle against HIV/AIDS. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire. And here's another invention from Africa, not quite so high-tech. In our new series, Stuff That Works, we look at good ideas that solve a specific problem. Today, trashy bags. Across West Africa, you can buy water on the street in little plastic baggies. In Ghana, a business called Trashy Bags turns those disposable baggies into sturdy products that can be used over and over again. Anna Boyko-Wyrock reports.
In Ghana's capital, Accra, pay 3 cents to a roaming street vendor, and you get a small plastic bag of clean water from a cooler atop her head. For a little more, you can also buy cold yogurt, ice cream, and chocolate milk in sealed baggies. But most people, when they're done eating or drinking, turn those colorful little bags right into litter.
They're everywhere, in every street, piles of them blocking the drains and causing a lot of trouble.
British expat Stuart Gold is the director of a company called Trashy Bags.
So we came up with the idea of taking this plastic, cleaning it up, disinfecting it, and then stitching it into bags and products, which we do.
Trashy Bags buys the discarded bags from collectors who scour the streets picking up the plastic trash. The bags are kind of like Ziploc sandwich bags, but stiffer and stronger. They're not as flimsy as you might think. Sew them together like patchwork, and they can hold a lot of weight. Two full-time washers scrub used plastic bags in giant tubs brimming with soap and disinfectant. The women wash these bags twice to get rid of dirt and germs. One of the workers is Alima Osman. She's from rural northern Ghana and has worked here since the company started 2 years ago. Osman says she used to sell food to make a living, but was always in debt. Since working at Trashy Bags, she can pay her bills every month. Stuart Gold says the business employs 60 full-time workers.
Now it's not just an environmental issue. It's become very much about employing the people.
Most of the employees piece together the clean bags to make an array of colorful products, including laptop cases and coin purses. Kwame Achampong is sewing a handbag designed by one of the factory workers.
I think we are doing recycling and I want to help my country and help myself too.
This is actually called the Trashy Smart Bag. It zips up into a pouch.
In the company's boutique, Stuart Gold shows off the newest design, a sturdy grocery bag that folds into itself for easy storage. Workshop manager Elvis Abolua says most customers are foreigners. Ghanaians don't usually buy them.
They like the concept, they like the products, but because of the cost. And then something that this is something that was thrown on the street is garbage. Why should I pay that much for garbage?
Abolua says getting more local customers is the company's next challenge. It's looking for sponsorship to reduce the cost of bags sold locally. For the World Vision Report, I'm Anna Boyko-Wyrock in Accra, Ghana.
To find out where you can purchase a trashy bag, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org, and you can find pictures of the bags there too.
I'm Moni Matlo from Johannesburg, South Africa, and you're listening to the World Vision Reports.
And we leave you today with an audio postcard we received from our Mexico correspondent, Grant Fuller. Grant recently returned from a reporting trip along Mexico's Copper Canyon Railway. One day, while he was waiting for the train to arrive, he overheard a man playing traditional ballads from the state of Chihuahua.
Soy del estado de Chihuahua.
Manuel Batista had borrowed another passenger's guitar to pass the time. Here he is at the train station in Cuauhtémoc, Mexico.
Deshizo guicha la barranca. Es muy corta la distancia. Ay, habita mi morena con su boquita risueña. Soy hijo de una humilde tarahumara. Por la noche se oyen los oídos de las fieras enojadas. Yo quiero mucho a mi morena, pobre bonita y cariñosa.
And that's the end of our show today. Remember, you can see lots of great pictures on our website, and you can read blogs from our reporters around the world. The address, worldvisionreport.org. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is our production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.